Welcome to Shorties, a short true crime story.
Happy Thursday.
Happy Thursday to you.
What do you got for me?
I got a story for you.
All right. I like to sit down and get a story told to me.
Okay. Well, you came to the right place.
Hell yeah.
All right. So it's 1977 and 17-year-old Dorothy Hogue Stratton is working at the local Dairy Queen in Vancouver, British Columbia. She's just doing your typical after-school job routine when a 28-year-old customer named Paul Snyder comes in one day and he is completely taken by Dorothy. Dorothy was beautiful. She was a tall and leggy blonde with tan skin and blue eyes. But she's 17 and he's 28, so it really doesn't matter what she looks like.
I was going to say 28-year-olds shouldn't be taken by 17-year-olds, in my opinion.
No. In most people's opinion.
Yeah.
The first time he laid eyes on Dorothy, he turned to his friend and said, quote, "That girl could make me a lot of money." And he proceeds to hit on her. And as if the age difference isn't bad enough, working at Dairy Queen at that point in the 70s meant that she was required to wear her hair in pigtails and this little uniform that looked like a very little girl uniform. Mm-hmm. So basically what I'm saying is that when Paul saw her, she looked extra young. Paul was the epitome of 1970s tacky style.
Ugh.
He had a thick porn star stash. He wore snakeskin boots and flared jeans. Rings on every finger.
And my big, nightmare.
And, oh, just wait. And big diamond encrusted chains. And then to complete the look, he made sure to keep his shirts unbuttoned so that you would see his chest hair.
God forbid.
Mm-hmm. He was determined to make her his. And I don't mean that in any kind of romantic way. I mean he was determined to groom her. Dorothy turned down his offer for a date, and she declined to give him her phone number. So what does Paul do? He gets her phone number from another DQ employee and starts calling Dorothy at home on a regular basis, pestering her to go out with him. Dorothy was open with those around her that she was turned off by this older, aggressive guy, and she continually rejected him. But like any determined piece of shit, he eventually wore her down. Dorothy said that she felt like if she just went on one date, then maybe he'd leave her alone. When Paul walked through the door and Dorothy's mom, Nellie, saw who was there to pick up her shy, naive 17-year-old daughter, she was pissed. She knew after taking one look at this dude that he was bad news. And, you know, moms know best.
Yes.
Not only did he look sleazy, but he was. Paul turned out to be a sometimes club promoter, sometimes pimp. Like a real life pimp.
God, that combo's brutal.
The combo is really brutal. It's like he actually pimped women out for money. Paul came from a troubled childhood and he dropped out of school in the seventh grade. By his teenage years, he was really insecure about how skinny he was, so he got into bodybuilding. And as an adult, everyone who knew him said he was obsessive about appearances. Whether he had it or not, he wanted to look like he had money. And he was very much a get-rich-quick scheme kind of guy. When he first met Dorothy, he had just returned to Vancouver from Los Angeles with his tail between his legs. He'd gone there to try to make it big as a Hollywood director, only to fail miserably. Instead of breaking into the industry, he spent months there driving limousines and pimping girls out before giving up and going back to Canada. So, when Paul realizes that his aggressive approach isn't working, he switches gears and he becomes soft and romantic and he wines and dines Dorothy. He showers her with flattery and gifts and takes her to nice restaurants, and he presents himself as someone who can really take care of her. And while I firmly believe that he weaseled his way into her good graces through manipulation, Dorothy was also 17 and naive, and her dad had been out of the picture since she was a toddler. So having an older male figure swoop in and take care of her probably felt nice.
It fulfilled probably a little bit of a void that she had.
Yeah. And then on top of that, Dorothy wanted a really simple picket white fence kind of future with a husband and kids in Vancouver. And she didn't think that she was beautiful, but actually rather like plain looking, which is so crazy because if you see her, she's just like breathtaking. So when this older guy sweeps her off her feet and then starts telling her how beautiful she is and how he could make her a huge movie star, it was very enthralling. And because she had only had one boyfriend before, which was in high school, obviously, she didn't realize how possessive and controlling Paul actually was. Instead, Dorothy perceived him as passionate, and she believed him when he said that he was the only one who saw her potential to be a highly respected movie star. He explained that becoming a movie star required baby steps and breaking into the industry in smaller ways. So he set up several photo shoots for her to begin a modeling career. And at first, Dorothy really enjoyed it. Then one day, Paul showed her that Playboy was conducting a nationwide search for a new playmate to promote for their 25th anniversary, and he believed that she could be chosen. All they needed to do was send in nude photos of her.
Oh, great.
Simple.
Simple.
She wasn't comfortable with this whatsoever, but Paul gets what Paul wants, and so she reluctantly agreed. Because she wasn't 18 yet, Paul had to forge Nellie's signature to get the photographer to agree to do the shoot to begin with. And then on the day of the shoot, after witnessing the dynamic between the couple, the photographer suggested that Paul leave.
Wow. Good for him. You don't always get that in photographers.
Well, he explained that a lot of girls don't feel comfortable shooting nude with an audience. So as angry as this made Paul, his ultimate goal was money and fame. So he relented and left Dorothy with the photographer. I don't think that's a good idea.
Oh, okay. So in my head, I thought it was like, this guy is abusive and scary. You need to leave, was how I interpreted it. Yeah.
No.
Whoops-a-daisy.
He meant, leave me with a 17-year-old that we're pretending is 18 so I can shoot her naked and she'll be comfortable.
I really take back that.
Yeah. Well, now you know.
Now he is actually like a lot of photographers.
Yeah,
take
exactly.
It back. Yeah.
So both Dorothy and the photographer later recalled that while she was nervous initially, by the end of the shoot, she felt very comfortable and was now actually really excited to submit the photos to Playboy. After submitting, Paul tells Dorothy that he wants to manage her impending career, and he persuades her to view it as a team. He makes her agree to a verbal, lifelong contract where it's agreed that everything she is projected to make will be split 50-50, and he makes her promise that he will always be present for every job. In August of 1978, a few weeks after the nude shoot, Playboy reached out to let her know she was selected as one of the finalists. And this was huge. Thousands and thousands of girls had submitted photos for this contest, so to be selected as one of the 16 finalists was a really big deal.
And even like back then, it was even more prestigious than it is now, obviously.
Yes, definitely.
It's like a massive deal.
Yeah. They told her that she'd be flown to Los Angeles for more test shoots. But when Paul learns that not only is Playboy only offering to fly her to Los Angeles, but that Paul is not allowed to be present at all, he is furious. But again, it's all about the dollar sign for him, so he relents and sends her off to LA by herself, but not before making her promise to call him every single day, multiple times a day. The moment Dorothy sets eyes on Los Angeles, she is in love. The warm weather, the beautiful people, the palm tree-lined streets, the limousine waiting to pick her up, and then getting dropped off at the famous, beautiful Playboy Mansion, she suddenly wanted to be there. Not for Paul, not for money, not for fame, for her. This property was like a movie set and unlike anything that she'd ever seen before. You know, it's big and lush, and there's staff there to wait on her hand and foot. The place is just crawling with beautiful people, and, you know, they even have a full-on zoo where you can play with the animals. Obviously, in our generation, the Playboy brand and the mansion has been revealed for what it really is, a not-so-glamorous rundown house with disgusting old men targeting girls young enough to be their granddaughters. But in the 70s and 80s, Playboy was in its heyday. Those old men were younger, not that that makes them any less predatory. And the whole brand and culture of Playboy was just different then. Getting an invite to the mansion was a big score, so celebrities were there all the time. It was an exciting and glamorous place to be, and the fact that Dorothy was hand-selected to be there, it was just all very exciting. What she and Paul did not realize was just how much she would be working while she was in town. From sunup to sundown, she was whisked from the mansion to photo shoots and back. Playboy's founder, Hugh Hefner, was known for socializing constantly and had some social event on the books for each evening, so there actually was no free time for Dorothy to get to a phone to call Paul. Plus, she was having a lot of fun and wasn't really thinking about calling him anyways. But obviously, that doesn't sit well with someone who is used to being in control. So Paul called on her constantly, all day long, he would call the mansion, the Playboy offices, the studios where Dorothy was shooting, and he could never get through to her. Playboy employees were used to dealing with boyfriends and husbands like this, so they made sure to intercept as much of the contact as possible so that Dorothy could focus on doing what she came to do. I mean, she was only supposed to be there for 2 or 3 days, so getting calls from her pushy boyfriend every hour was insane. Before she had flown to LA, Paul had warned her that Hef might want to sleep with her. And if that happened, Paul wanted her to know he was cool with it.
Thanks, Paul.
Mm-hmm. He told her she needed to do whatever she needed to do. And that was shocking to Dorothy. In her mind, she's going there for business and she's in a committed relationship with Paul. So why would she even consider sleeping her way to the top? And more so, why would Paul be okay with her doing so? She later said that on that trip, she did meet Hef. They exchanged pleasantries, but didn't really interact, and he didn't try to sleep with her. So she finishes her work and flies back to Vancouver. Paul was pissed that she had been radio silent while she was away, especially since she had, you know, promised to call him multiple times a day. So she had to work really hard to appease him.
Oh, I'm sorry, Paul.
Yeah. Things were volatile with them, and then to make matters worse, she doesn't win the contest, and that was quite the blow to her and to him. But, I mean, he's got such a fragile ego, everything is a blow to him. However, Playboy requested that she come back to LA to pose for upcoming issues instead. So she excitedly agrees, but the same sort of process happens where Paul isn't allowed to join her, and she's too busy to call him, and it pisses him off. Her first trip had only been a couple of days, but this time she was there for several weeks. Playboy loved her, and she's eventually selected as Playmate of the Month for the August 1979 issue. After this, a ton of work opportunities start pouring in, so she and Paul decide to move to Los Angeles permanently, where he will officially begin working as her manager. But once they're actually living down there, Paul sees firsthand how enamored people are with Dorothy. By many accounts, Dorothy didn't experience that typical situation of like a small town girl coming to the big city with dreams and aspirations, only to then get crushed by the industry. It seemed more like she experienced a very quick surge of success and that Hollywood was very taken with her. So she's like making connections and booking jobs at a rapid pace. And the more friends she makes, the more Paul feels she's slipping away from him because no one likes Paul. Everyone around Dorothy gets bad vibes from him, and what they experience firsthand is proof that he is a controlling asshole. So what does Paul do when he feels like he's losing control of his little puppet? He proposes. He tells her that it's the right move for her career because no one respects him as her boyfriend, but the title of husband will finally make people listen to him. By now, Dorothy has had a significant taste of independence, and every single one of her new friends has expressed concern over her relationship with Paul. And that's on top of years of her family already disapproving of him. So when he senses her reluctance to get married, he starts guilting her. He tells her she wouldn't even be where she is if it hadn't been for him. He reminds her of the verbal lifelong agreement they made. He tells her that she owes him. And as usual, he gets his way, but she doesn't tell her family. So Paul is feeling like the big man on campus when he finally scores an invitation to the mansion's infamous Halloween party. From the moment they enter, he is hounding Dorothy to introduce him to Hef. When they find him, Hef exchanges pleasantries and tries to move on, but Paul is determined to talk to him about business ventures. And Hef's like, we're at a party. So he sort of humors him, but quickly gets out of the conversation and immediately goes to his security and tells them that he wants a full background check on Paul.
So he even got a really bad vibe. If Hugh Hefner is meeting you and going, you're a bad egg, that's a bad sign.
Exactly. And then later on, when he learns that Paul is trying to operate as Dorothy's manager, Hef connected her with actual business managers and financial advisors of her own. He told her it's always smarter and cleaner to outsource that kind of stuff and just not mingle it with personal relationships. So I'm sure you can imagine how Paul felt getting cut out in that way and at the advice of Hugh Hefner, no less.
That didn't go how he thought it would.
Oh, no, not at all. Now, Playboy always grooms and adjusts their playmates through surgeries and other insane changes in order to conform to their image, but they really zeroed in on Dorothy as a sort of poster child for the brand. They suggested that she change her last name from Hoag Stratton to simply Stratton, and she agreed. Dorothy starts getting booked for regular acting jobs, and she continues to do promotional work for Playboy that allows her to travel for the first time in her whole life. Playboy is very strict about playmates and the roles that their boyfriends and husbands play in their jobs, because it doesn't exactly work for them to send Dorothy out as a sex object to promote their brand and then have her controlling boyfriend looming in the background when she's posing for photos with fans. The more she traveled without him, the pushier Paul became about getting married. By this point, they've been engaged for a few months, and she has continually avoided setting a wedding date. And every time her girlfriends ask why she would even want to marry him, she would just shrug and respond, "I owe him. He believed in me. He's the reason I'm even here." As always, Paul wears her down, and she eventually agrees to elope in Vegas with just a couple of people in attendance. Someone asked why her family wasn't present, and she blushed and said, "I haven't told them." Even though Paul still viewed Dorothy as his primary meal ticket, he did attempt to do his own work. And like classic Paul, it was nothing but gross stuff. He did things like organize and promote wet t-shirt contests, wet underwear contests, and even collaborated with some club owners to create the famous Chippendales male strip clubs, which I had no idea that he had any involvement in. He was feeling more secure and confident now that they were married, that Dorothy wasn't going to go anywhere. Paul still reminded her that if needed, she could sleep with Hugh Hefner. And still, Dorothy was shocked and grossed out by the idea. While Hef's sexual escapades are well known, Dorothy never admitted to sleeping with him, nor did he ever admit to sleeping with her. None of the people closest to either of them, especially the people around Hef, who knew every grimy detail of his escapades, had ever heard of them sleeping together. Hef always maintained that he had more of a protective father figure type dynamic with Dorothy, because just like everyone else in her life, he also didn't like Paul. But his reasoning was that he, quote, had a pimp-like quality about him.
Well, he's spot on. It takes one to know one.
That's exactly what I thought. I was like, it takes one to know one, dude. April of 1980 was a huge month for Dorothy. It was announced that she was chosen as Playmate of the Year, and her issue would be released a few months later. Simultaneously, she was cast in a movie called They All Laughed, starring Audrey Hepburn and John Ritter. Filming would take her away from Paul for several weeks while they shot in New York, something she was relieved to realize. Because the biggest development that month was actually a personal one. Dorothy had finally started to wake up to how toxic this relationship was, and she was secretly exploring the idea of filing for divorce. She was so serious about this that when Paul said he wanted to join her in New York, she lied to him and told him it would be a closed set, which means no one but cast and crew was allowed. These huge, rapid changes happening in her career, coupled with Dorothy being on a closed set for several weeks, thousands of miles away from him, left Paul feeling, again, like he was losing his grip on her. He became more demanding and told her that he wanted complete control over her finances and business deals. And for the first time, she stood up for herself and told him no, and she left for New York. The cast and crew later said Dorothy was prompt, professional, and a total joy to work with. She seemed to be exuding happiness like she hadn't before, and everyone gravitated towards her, including the film's director, Peter Bogdanovich. Peter said they fell in love fast and hard and were inseparable during shooting. Even though she was having an affair with the film's director, they were both really discreet about it. Not many people knew, and both parties were very professional on set. Obviously, Paul senses a noticeable difference in her. And then in June of 1980, he learns that Dorothy has closed their joint bank accounts. Dorothy's attorney then communicates to him that he and Dorothy are now legally, physically, and financially separated, and she is seeking a divorce. Paul tries relentlessly to get in touch with her, but she's created a thick shield of attorneys to block that from happening. And when Paul finds out that not only is Dorothy in a relationship, but she's moved into Peter's home in Bel Air, he buys a gun and hires a private investigator to track Dorothy's every move. The first 4 months of her relationship with Peter, everyone around Dorothy said that she was simply radiant. She was happy and in love, but she confides in some friends that she feels guilty about the way that she cut Paul off. She didn't even have a conversation with him, and she wants to give them both closure. So they meet for lunch on August 8th, and it was evident that they'd both gone into that meeting with very different intentions. She thought they would amicably end things, and he thought he would win her back. So it was heavy and emotional, and it ended with her removing the last of her things from the apartment that they used to share. She offered a financial settlement in the hopes that they could both move on for good. So they agreed to meet again on August 14th, and Dorothy would drop the money off to him at their old apartment. On the morning of the 14th, Dorothy met with her attorneys and business manager to discuss the settlement. They advised her to give him a lump sum rather than alimony. Just before she left the meeting, her business manager suggested that rather than meet with him herself, she should have her attorneys handle it. Dorothy reassured them that she was comfortable doing it herself. Paul had seemed heartbroken but accepted that it was over, and she believed they were on good terms and she wanted to keep it that way. The last thing she said to them before leaving was, quote, "I'd like to remain his friend." So remember, Paul was having Dorothy followed?
Yes.
His goal in having the PI follow her was that he wanted to catch Dorothy doing anything that might help him demand more money from her in the divorce. He and the PI, whose name was Mark Goldstein, had even concocted a plan to wire Paul in advance of this meeting on the 14th in the hopes that Paul could manipulate Dorothy into making some kind of verbal agreement to a higher sum. And then having it recorded would give him a better leg up if he took her to court later down the road.
He's trash.
Oh, yeah. But then that didn't happen because this is 1980 and that was like some sophisticated technology that was hard to come by. Yeah. So they just settled on Mark tailing her like normal and waiting outside in his car. Mark clocked her arrival to Paul's apartment as 12:30 p.m. For the first 2 hours that Dorothy was inside, Mark called to see how things were going. And in code, so that she wouldn't catch on, Paul told him it was going well. Mark tries calling again later in the afternoon, but no one picks up. That evening, after Paul's roommates get home, they noted that Dorothy's car was outside and Paul's bedroom door was closed. They assumed that this meant the former couple were actually making up and the roommates just went about their night. Around 11 p.m., the PI calls and asks one of the roommates to get Paul on the line. Because he's pissed. He had been instructed by Paul to wait outside and follow Dorothy home. But that was almost 12 hours ago, and she still hadn't left, and Paul wasn't picking up his calls. So as the roommate began walking towards Paul's bedroom door, she said she had a terrible feeling that something was very wrong. She knocked, but there was no answer. She waited and knocked again. Then she opened the door to find what she described as something out of a horror movie. Blood and brain matter covered the floors and walls, and Dorothy and Paul's nude bodies were found next to each other, both having been killed with a singular shotgun blast to the face. Police later determined that Paul raped and shot Dorothy within an hour of her arrival. He then sodomized her corpse. And an hour later, after his second phone call with the PI where he stated everything was going well, he laid down next to her body and shot himself. In the days leading up to the murder-suicide, Paul's friends remember him saying, "Did you guys know that when a playmate dies, Playboy tries to pull all their photos for publication?" For whatever reason, that remark didn't alarm anyone, but he was right nonetheless. Playboy sells sex, and death isn't sexy. They weren't concerned with respect or ethics or morality, but rather how an inconvenient death would impact their image negatively. The editors did whatever they could to block Dorothy's October issue from being released, but it was too late. So the 1980 October issue of Playboy ran nude photos of a recently murdered woman. Peter Bogdanovich released a statement after her death that said, quote, "Dorothy Stratton was as gifted and intelligent an actress as she was beautiful, and she was very beautiful indeed, in every way imaginable, most particularly in her heart. She and I fell in love during our picture and had planned to be married as soon as her divorce was final. The loss to her mother and father, her sister and brother, to my children, to her friends, and to me is larger than we can calculate. But there is no life Dorothy's touched that has not been changed for the better through knowing her, however briefly. Dorothy looked at the world with love and believed that all people were good deep down. She was mistaken, but it is among the most generous and noble errors we can make. And that is the story of Dorothy Stratton.
I just keep getting the chills throughout the entire story. It's so horrifying.
I didn't find any record of Paul being like physically abusive. Mm-hmm. It's not like certain types of abuse are worse than others, but I think when it's not physical abuse, it's a lot, it's more sly. It's more under the radar.
There's no evidence of it other than like the, you know, emotional trauma that's being caused to the person.
But, and if you're trying to explain away certain behaviors, or you're calling controlling behavior passion and you don't know otherwise, it's just sneakier, and everybody is really susceptible to that kind of abuse.
And you can justify it too. Like you can find a way to justify it when you want to. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to put your finger on it.
And it just infuriates me to no end when somebody kills someone and then commits suicide.
So cowardly.
But I also read that Paul had a almost irrational lifelong fear of going to jail. And he had always told people if he ever thought he was going to go to jail for something, he would kill himself first.
He's just the ultimate coward. He doesn't want to answer for any of his crimes.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Well, you did a very good job telling that story. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening.
No problem. Love you.
Okay, love you.
Bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you enjoy listening. We owe everything to the many journalists, authors, filmmakers, psychiatrists, and psychologists whose extensive work and expertise we pulled from to share this episode with you. To view detailed source material, as well as content from today, please visit us on Instagram and TikTok at Shorty's Podcast. We really love doing this show, and if you'd like to help with the continued creation of it, you can support by donating to our Patreon, patreon.com/shortiespodcast. This episode was hosted by Ashley Brumley Johnson and Anika Tharina.